children, we're starting.
That's right.
Showtime!
Another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Shutters Inc. with Shelton Muller.
You might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to episode 89 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from audio2u.com. With me on the line once again, Shelton Muller. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Bruce. I'm really well. Really well.
Excellent.
It's a post-eclipse Shutters Inc. podcast.
It is.
Yeah.
Man, I can't believe your bad luck.
Oh, can you believe it? Yeah. Out there with my monopod and the 300mm, which is at the moment my longest lens.
Yeah.
Must fix that. And I'm looking up and all I can see is this hazy outline through Melbourne cloud of a bright orange object. And I'm going, "Doh!" You know? And meanwhile, Bruce Williams is up in Sydney with clear starry skies, ringing me up going, "Hey, how you doing down there? You getting the photos?" And I'm saying, "No." And he's going, I'm getting the photos. So folks, for this week's podcast, I'd like to introduce our resident photographer, Bruce Williams. How did you go shooting at night?
Mate, I had a great time. I walked out there at about 7:30, I think it must have been, and I just happened to look up. I was going outside to do something else, and I just happened to look up and saw the moon, and at that stage there was, you know, maybe an eighth of the moon obscured in shadow, and I was like, "Oh, Max, come out here, look at this," you know. And, so then I went and grabbed my tripod and my camera and set up, put the 300mm on there, and the first few shots that I took, I think the majority of the shots that I took prior to the full eclipse, I was shooting at 200 ISO. And while the moon was bright, I mean, I could have shot them handheld. I mean, I was shooting you know, 1/125th or a 1/200th at f8. You know, and I probably didn't even need to be shooting at f8 in all honesty, you know, because it's a pretty flat object.
Yes.
But, you know, as the shadow, you know, crept further and further across the face of the moon, so I was able to, you know, slow the shutter speed down. What I eventually realized, and this is one of the downsides of, you know, your LCD size on the back of your camera, is that you can look at a shot on there and think, "Man, that looks great." But then when you come back inside, you know, because what I was doing was I'd just switch the camera off, leave it on the tripod, take the memory card out, walk back in here into my study, stick the card in the card reader, and I've got Lightroom. There's an option in Lightroom that says, you know, automatically detect and import when a card's inserted in the card reader. So Lightroom would just pop up straight away and it'd automatically select the images and say, "Do you want to import these?" And I just go, "Yeah, import." And then you look at them on this, you know, gorgeous 23-inch widescreen monitor that I've got.
Right.
And it's like, ooh, they're not as sharp as they looked on the 2.5-inch LCD.
Yes.
And what it was simply motion blur from, you know, having a four-second shutter. And you wouldn't have thought a four-second shutter would make that much. Like, you wouldn't have thought that the moon would move much in 4 seconds, but obviously it does.
Well, we hurtle through space at about 1,000 miles an hour or something. So, you know, it does. It does move.
It doesn't,
you know, a 1 second exposure will blur the moon. It really can, because we are moving quite fast.
Yeah. So once the moon became fully eclipsed, I actually bumped the ISO up to 800, which, you know, obviously introduced more sensor noise. My black sky wasn't quite, well, it was still black,
clean.
But it had, it wasn't as clean. It had red specks all over it. But I was still, you know, still happy with the shots that I got. And it was nice to see the comments, not only on Audio to You, where I posted 8 images, but also to the image I posted to Flickr, where someone said, "Man, that looks awesome. You know, what filtering did you use?" And it was like, no filtering, no color tweaking, nothing. That's just how it was, you know?
In Melbourne, we of course experienced it, but behind cloud, or at least where I am in Melbourne anyway, and I didn't really see it until, of course, it was all finished. And then we all stood in the backyard and looked up by the time it was finished and the clouds had cleared, and I've never seen the moon so bright. It was this big, white object. And I took a photograph, handheld, you know, 400th of a second because it was so bright.
Yeah, right.
And at 100 ISO or something, and was just, you know, incredible. My son and I are standing there and we're casting a full sharp shadow, you know, at night.
Yeah.
Like it was daylight. It was quite incredible, you know. And and all over the world on Flickr and all, so many people are emailing the shots that they took because it was an incredible event. I did get one email that said, hey, did you guys get the lunar eclipse down in Australia? we get both the sun and the moon down here, just in case, you know.
You thought we were missing out.
You know, Americans, I haven't got exclusive rights on the lunar and solar objects. You know, come on, people. You know, we even speak English and have the wheel down here, you know.
I don't know if you've seen it this morning, but Phil Peck has posted an image to our Flickr group with all of the stages of the eclipse in an arc in one image. Right. I don't know if you've seen it. Is it worth checking out? It looks great.
Oh, look, and it's great that the Shutter's Inc. site has taken on, you know, such a good life of its own.
Yeah.
It's, you know, but yeah, I'm looking at the image right now, Phil, and it's what a fabulous job you've done.
Yeah.
You know, a really great job of that lunar eclipse. Well done, well done to you, because it shows, you know, all those stages, sharp, well exposed. Yeah,
yep.
Absolutely fabulous. And that's why our Flickr site is such a great thing. While we're on the subject of the Flickr site, Jamie, you asked the question, what's the protocol for a second shooter in a wedding? And I've responded by saying, I will answer that. So here's the question is, should the main photographer give credit to the second photographer for his pictures? And is the second photographer allowed or should have permission to use those pictures in his website if he gives proper credit to the main photographer? Anyone? Reminds me of that scene from Ferris Bueller. Anyone? Anyone? Okay, well, we did answer. And here we did, you know, we did reply. I think that really depends on the relationship that you have and who you are to this photographer. I've often had photographers come along and shoot as a second photographer on my weddings. Now, either they're there for different reasons. I used to bring Greg, my very good friend, along because I was training him to become a photographer. I saw he had so much potential. Greg was a fabulous assistant to me on a wedding. He realized that his first role was there to help me do my job. And that meant either carrying the case, setting up the tripod, fluffing the dress of the bride, whatever it needed, and he did. He was always allowed to bring his camera. He was always allowed to shoot. But he was the kind of guy who realized that this was a privilege, and he acted accordingly. So he never got in my way. He never took over. He always just assisted. And he would help me at the expense of his own photograph. But he, after a while, gathered the experience and a body of work based on the weddings that he'd been on with me, that he could say, hey, you know, I've got these photographs, I know how to shoot a wedding. And the first time I double booked myself and I needed another photographer, I sent Greg out and he did a lovely job. In the meantime, he was learning and he kept, you know, his place. I didn't mind that at the end of a few weddings with me, he could print out some prints and use them as a folio, because I knew that he could have set those photographs up himself by now. What often happens with a second photographer is that they'll work, they'll see what the photographer will do, and they say, hey, that's great, and they'll take a photograph. The question remains, though, could the second photographer have taken that photograph from scratch? In other words, had the main photographer not been there, would the assistant have been able to place the bride and groom in that light, in that setting, pose them, you know, and set it all up and do it himself? If he then takes the photograph that he's taken standing side by side with the main photographer, puts it on his website and says, hey, look at the great wedding I shot, he's lying, because he could not have produced that image himself from scratch. He is presenting himself as something he isn't to his clients. And that, to me, is the issue. You should never present work that you've basically, well, almost plagiarized from the main photographer. If the bride and if the groom are being photographed by the main photographer, and you take one of the bridesmaids or the group of bridesmaids and the groomsmen or the bridal party or whatever off, and you do some portraits of them that have nothing to do with the main photographer, that's your work. And you should have a relationship with the main photographer that says, you can do that. you're the assistant, you serve a valuable purpose. But, you know, he should know that you're also there for your own ends, and that's the way it works. It's like an apprenticeship. If you're using photographs that almost plagiarize what he's just set up, well, he'd have every right to say, mate, you know, you didn't set that up, I did. You just stuck a camera over my shoulder and said, ooh, isn't that good? It doesn't work that way. The who uses and how you use and the permission for the photographs, that depends on the relationship that you have with the main photographer and he has with you and what the motivation is for your being there. If he understands that you will be setting yourself up as a photographer, then, you know, then you should be able to at least get something from that in terms of photography for your portfolio. You've got to discuss that all. But don't turn up at a wedding, do copies of everything the photographer that's, you know, the main photographer does and says, this is my work, because quite clearly it isn't. That's the only thing I can really say. It's something that I've had happen. It's turned around and bitten me in the bum. I've had photographers come and, you know, stand right next to me. They're motivated. They said they wanted to come, they wanted to learn, but unfortunately they've taken too much advantage of the situation. And they've seen something I've set up, put the camera over my shoulder, and, oh, that's good, and put it on their little website and said, hey, you know, I shot this. Well, they pressed the button, but all the work of making that image and setting it up was not done by that photographer. So I hope that answers your question, Jamie, in a balanced degree, remembering that you both have rights and that you both have needs. So, you know, work out. It's a dominant and subordinate relationship, as per our podcast. Know who you are, where you stand, and make sure that any images that you purport to be your own are your own and will not offend the main photographer in any way, as if they've been copied, plagiarized, you know, slightly adapted. That's just not right. Not right at all, because you wouldn't have set that up. You couldn't have set that up without that photographer doing so in the first place.
Now, you were going to say something about Flickr?
Yes. I'm actually enjoying the Flickr site from my own perspective, because I'm getting to see two things.
Right.
I'm getting to see where our photographers are excelling, and there are some fabulous, fabulous things. Fabulous images on, and some great photographers in the Shutters Inc. group. And it sort of makes me think, well, what am I doing here half the time? you know, you guys already seem to know how to take photographs. But it's also there's a new from Mr. Nikon. Now, I don't know who you are, Mr. Nikon, but I love that image. And a very, very high-key bridal portrait.
Oh, okay.
But there's, yeah, and of course you guys are, you know, talking about questions, and there's a forum there, so it helps me to work out what people need to know, and because I'm seeing familiar names there, I'm seeing your photographs and your collections. And the other thing is, you can look at mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can go to my Flickr site and say, well, you know, these are Shelton's photographs. I have a lot of wedding photographs I've uploaded recently, so because I've had a fair few inquiries about how to shoot weddings, and you know, what are the shots, how do you do them, and that, of course, I'm reminded of you, Jamie, who hopefully has done his wedding and all has worked out well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if you are listening, please join the Flickr site, the Shutters Inc. group, and become part of this, because it really is working well for everybody and keeping us all together, you know, and helping each other out photographically, which is very, very important.
Definitely.
And we're, you know, when things like this happen, like our lunar eclipse, we're all united in the one, you know, aim, and that is to help each other get better photographs and to see each other's photographs. And that sort of thing is just fabulous. So,
yep.
You know, thank you so much. A couple of emails to go through. Shall we begin?
Well, yeah, for sure.
I have one from Benny, who's in Idaho. Thank you very much, Benny. Now, I don't exactly know how to pronounce your last name, but it's spelled B-A-U-G-H-M-A-N, so it's Bauman, Borman, Boffman. Mm-hmm. Not exactly sure, but let's just call you Benny for the moment, shall we? And thank you so much for your email from Idaho. And he says, I've just recently found your podcast. I think I heard about you from the Pro Photography Show podcast. I think you guys are a hoot, which is a good thing. I like how to visualize and how to see of your shows, as compared to how to click a button or do a step in Photoshop. I'm still in the process of listening to all your podcasts. I've gone back to the first show, and I'm picking the pods that interest me, and I'm up to June 2006. Boy, we've been doing this a while, haven't we?
Yeah.
I put them in my MP3 player and mow the grass, walk for miles, or do something else. He says he has a couple of questions. And my gear consists of a D80, nice camera, a Sigma 18-25, a Nikon 50mm 1.8, a Nikon 7300, and a Sunpak tripod. I like to shoot everything, but I enjoy wildlife and landscape here. I have not won the lottery, so I'm not flush with money. Hey, you and me both. Here is one question. Would I be better served by buying an 18-200 VR lens or a 12-24 lens? I know that the 12-24 would be great for wide-angle landscape lens. The 12-24 would also be good for shooting people and portraits. That's very true, in its own unique wide-angle sort of way. Yeah. But I'm thinking the trade-off for a VR lens would be in my favor. It is not as long as the 7300, but it would help in low light. That's an interesting question. If you're a landscape wildlife shooter and you already have a 70-300, Benny, I think you are okay. What you don't have is a real wide lens like the 12-24. And if you're a landscape shooter, I'm wondering how you're living without it. You've got an 18-125, and no doubt you've used that for your landscapes at the 18 end. But the 12-24 would be better designed for that, and is a fantastic lens. The other thing you could do would be to perhaps opt not to go for the Nikkor, which is very expensive lens, and maybe get the Takina, which they also have a 12-24, I believe, or the Tamron 11-18, which I have, and which I have been very, very pleased with. And they're about half the price. So perhaps, if you were, depending on your budget, you could go for the Tamron 11-18, and maybe trade the 18-125 in on an 18-200 VR and get the best of both. It might cost you a little more, but it's an option that might work for you. But if I only had one choice, seeing as you've already you're already covered fairly well from 18-300 with a 50mm 1.8 there in between for available light work, my answer to you would be definitely get the wide angle end of the scale. You're a landscape shooter and you haven't got a really wide lens, then definitely get something designed to shoot that end of the scale. The 18-125 is great, and the 18-200 VR get excellent reviews, but they are lenses which do compromise at both ends of the scale. All lenses in that range do. They have to, because there's no way that you can have a lens that gives you that sort of focal length and that sort of variety without a compromise. If you have a lens that is designed, you know, for less focal versatility or focal length variability, like a 12-24, it's designed to perform better within that range. So your optics will be better, your pincushion and barrel distortion will be better, your chromatic aberrations will be better, simply because the lens is designed for a particular purpose, as against something like an 18-200 or an 18-125, which is designed to suit as many purposes as possible.
It's a jack of all trades rather than a master of one.
Yes, exactly. So that would be my thought. Benny, if you're a landscape shooter, you really won't know yourself until you get something really wide, like an 11 or a 12 or a 10, and to shoot with that. You know, the other option could be to get yourself the nice Tamron 14mm, but, you know, which is a prime lens. It's a beautiful lens, and of course there are others that you can get. They're very expensive, though. So think about the 12-24, the Tamron 11-18, or the Takina in that same range. They are very, very nice lenses. The second question you have you used a monopod much? Not much, but I do have one. I don't use it a lot, but I did get it out the other night. If I've used it at concerts, I've used it for, you know, certain portrait shoots and things like that with a 300mm, but they are very handy to have. And as you mentioned it, you said that you had a guy who took one from your camera club to the zoo, and it got in the way. Well, maybe he just didn't use it very, very well. So, look, a monopod, well, wouldn't be my first choice of purchase if I had other things to buy, but they are very, very handy. So just hope that helps you, Benny. Let me know what you think. If you do get a wide-angle lens, we will expect you to send us some photographs taken with it.
Quick question. Why would you buy a monopod over a tripod when you can use a tripod as a monopod if you want it?
Because a monopod is already designed, you just have to, you know, untwist it and it's there. It's not designed to keep things, you know, perfectly stable or you know, solid as a tripod would, simply because, you know, it won't stand on its own. But it's basically there to, for instance, if you're using a long lens in lower light,
I understand the purpose. All I'm saying is I don't understand why there's even a market for monopods. Because I will just, if I want a monopod, I'll just grab the tripod and just extend one leg.
Yeah, yeah, which you can do. It's much heavier. It's much heavier and more to carry around. And you've still got, with the monopod, you can have a simpler head. You know, something that just screws in with a little ball head or whatever. Whereas, of course, on a tripod, you've got a thumping great ball head or joystick head or a 3D head or whatever you've got. So it does serve a different purpose. It is a little faster, but it wouldn't be the first thing I would buy if indeed, you know, I had other things on my list. But they are very, very handy. I picked one up secondhand for a few dollars at a photo flea market once. I thought, oh, okay, there you go. It was like $10 or something, and it was, you know, it was worth having. Yeah. And I have used it from time to time. And a lot of photographers rely on them very heavily. I don't, you know.
Right.
But my shooting style is perhaps a little different. Either I'm going to handhold or I'm going to be on a tripod. They're usually my two decisions.
I must admit, I have quite often seen, you know, sports photographers with their big 300mm Apo lenses on monopods.
Mm-hmm.
That
yes.
makes sense.
Because they can turn and move with the soccer players or the football players or whatever it might be very quickly, which you can't do with a tripod.
Yeah.
You can lower, you can, you know, and you can just pick it up and move to another position, you know, very, very quickly. Yes, so for those applications, a monopod, for those guys, indispensable.
Hmm.
You know, indispensable. If you, yeah, you watch the football coverage or the soccer coverage or whatever, and you see the photographers with their big lenses on the outside, yeah, they're always on monopods. Very, very rarely are they not. So, yes, but for a landscape shooter like yourself, I don't know. I think you really need a good, solid tripod that, you know, will carry your gear and keep it nice and stable, Benny. So wouldn't be at the top of my list for what you do, I don't think. So, you know, that was just the main one. We're starting to get some window light portraits through.
So
thank you very much.
And some great stuff.
We have had some great stuff. So, but we're still not enough. You know, we want you guys, come on, it only takes a little bit of time to organize somebody, sit them near a window and get a portrait taken. So we'd really love to have some more input on our window light portrait competition.
Yeah.
We did get another.
Speaking of which, before we move on, speaking of which, we should probably get a banner graphic for the prize.
A banner graphic?
Like just a graphic to put onto the website to say, hey, we've got a copy of Pro 11 to give away.
Yep.
Would be a little bit more, you know.
Look a bit more funky?
Yeah.
You want an animated GIF?
Oh, look, if they've got an animated GIF, that's fine. If it's just a static JPEG, so be it.
All right. Well, we'll put one on. We'll get that organized.
Yeah.
That way you'll be able to click on that and find out what we're doing.
Yep.
Yep, absolutely.
So in case you weren't listening last week, we've got a copy of Corel Paint Shop Pro 11 to give away. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And it's a great program. It really is. Fantastic program for image enhancement. Lots of one-click fixes and lots of very comprehensive tools that, you know, you can use layers, you can do text, you can do all sorts of things. It's very, very, you know, comprehensive. And yet at the same time, you know, can do a lot of really cool one-click things. So, you know, don't underestimate it because it ain't Photoshop. It's fabulous. It really, really is.
Awesome.
We have two girl listeners.
We do.
We do, yes. Thank you, Julie, from Nashville, Tennessee. We appreciate that there is yet another female in our midst. And she says she's been listening to our podcast for 2 years. Julie, it's taking you a little while to own up to being our other female listener. We've been
talking
about this.
She's obviously embarrassed.
Maybe. Yeah, no need to be embarrassed. We do, you know, this is not a fraternity here. We, you know, nice to have the sisters along. So thank you very much. Apparently, we have the best accents.
Yeah.
Now, mine is a hybrid, and yours, of course, is an Aussie. But
that's,
you know, that's really nice of you to say, Julie. You keep us posted and enter the competition. So, you know, we want to see something from you very much. Bob Fisher, thank you very much for your window light portraits and the pictures of the woman you picked up in the grocery store. In inverted commas. I got my little fingers going up in the inverted commas position now. It's certainly an interesting couple of photographs. Thank you very much for that. I don't know whether you've put those on the Audio to You website, have you, Bruce?
Not yet. I was going to wait until... Well, I'm open to suggestions here. I was going to wait until we'd finished the competition or you know, the week when we announced the winner. I was going to publish the whole lot as a group.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, but I'm open to suggestions. Do you think I should just post them up as they get emailed in?
I think there's something a little tongue-in-cheek about this, these images Bob has sent us. But I would certainly suggest that we start posting up the... I would suggest we start posting them up so people can see what they've got to do.
Okay, well...
And of course, what they've got to be.
Actually, here's an idea. Maybe what I'll do is each Sunday when we publish the podcast, I'll put up as a group whichever images have come in through the week.
Sure.
That's probably a good compromise.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. Okay, I'll do Terrific. That. So along with this episode, there will be whatever submissions we've had so far.
Yes. So. Good. Well, I thought what we'd do today is talk about again, talking about highlighting the subject. It's a problem that I see raising its ugly head all the time in photography, and I'll keep talking about it as often as need to, simply because there is nothing better for the human mind than reminder.
Yep.
You know, we need to hear things several times before we actually, you know, and that's human nature, before we actually get the idea. And apparently we need to do something 21 times before it becomes a strong enough synaptic pathway to make us do it again. And there's no way known.
Just as a side note, I had to cover the concept of audio compression so many times in building the pod on sign language to get the message across, so I know exactly where you're coming from.
Yeah, that's, you know, and it's fair enough. You know, sometimes you can be photographing for years, and all of a sudden, it just hits you.
Yeah.
Is that it? Oh, now I get it. Moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll be in the middle of photographing something, and a word, a sentence, a phrase, an image will come into you, and I go, oh, is that it?
Yeah.
Now I get it. Now I know why it hasn't worked before and how I can make it work in the future. So often what we're doing is just presenting much the same principle but in different contexts or in a different manner. So basically highlighting the subject is about dominance and subordination. And of course that's marriage as well. You know, that's the key to a successful marriage as well. So, you know, who will be the dominant, who will be the subordinate, of course, is for each married couple to work out. But usually the wife is the dominant one and the man is the yes dear sort of situation. And that's the safest bet. But dominance and subordination basically is just another way of saying, well, look, here's the subject, bingo, and everything else around it is subordinate, interacts in a subordinate way to support, you know, that subject, not to distract from it. It's like a human relationship. And I'm not talking about dominance and subordination, but I'm talking about that, you know, in human relationships, your friends and, you know, your family are there to support you, not fight with you. And it's the same in the photograph, whereby you've got a subject. Now, the interesting thing about the subject is that the entire frame might be full of the subject. That might be the case in a landscape. In a landscape, the entire frame, everything pretty well, is the subject. So what is dominant and what is subordinate in that? Well, that's hard to know, but provided that in that image, anything that is distracting, of course, taking you away from a flow through the landscape, is going to need to be removed somehow, either by, you know, changing your positioning or your composition, moving up the hill a little bit, whatever it might be. But if you've got something like a portrait, a still life, you know, a macro photograph, something like that, a wedding photograph, dominance and subordination is an absolute must to understand, because what the photographer needs to do is control the sequence, the size, the power, the dominance within the frame of that which he has decided, she has decided, is the subject, the reason for this image. And you can do that through size. Obviously, you know, if something's really big and everything else is very small, it's going to be dominant. Color can be very, very powerful way to make something dominant and subordinate. I've posted and shown often a photograph that I took years ago of a tiny little red flower in amidst a sea of just green bulbs that haven't quite bloomed yet. Now, it is very small, and yet it is dominant because it's red. It's the only red thing, and everything else is shades of green. So size is one thing, but sometimes a small object cleverly placed in a dominant third and, you know, of a strong color is a very powerful way to make something dominant. Everything else is subordinate. even though that's small. It's sort of like the bully at school. He might have been a tiny little kid, but he had attitude, you know? I look back on high school now, I think, why didn't I just beat that kid up, you know? Why didn't I just take him and beat him up? Because he had attitude, you know? He just bluffed his way. No one ever wanted to mess with him because he had attitude. Well, if you apply that in your photographs, you know, if you give something attitude, you put it in the right place, it can be a dominant subject. Warm colored objects dominate colder ones. That's often, you know, that's very, very true. And sometimes, of course, as we've talked about, your position within the frame can make even a small object dominant. And that is, of course, if it is placed within a dynamic, you know, spot in the golden mean, those horizontal and vertically dissecting thirds. I have a photograph I took in Vietnam of a man in a field of wet rice paddies, and he's got this mountainous backdrop. It's up near Ninh Binh in Vietnam, if anybody's ever been there. And I wanted to photograph him. He was great, but there was no way known I could get close enough, no matter what lens. And I thought, well, the only way that I can actually highlight him is to place him on that third, minimize my depth of field, put him in that dynamic position and minimize the depth of field. And that's exactly what I did. Now, if you look at that photograph, there's a heck of a lot going on in it. But your eye is immediately taken there. One, because he's in the lower right, you know, intersecting thirds, and minimal depth of field ensures that he's not vying for dominance. He has dominance. Everything else is subordinate. It's a context to him, even though there's a lot there. Just the placement of it and the depth of field makes him, of course, the dominant thing. And there's no argument in that at all, in the image. So it's not always about necessarily being able to remove the subordinate things. It's about making them subordinate and the key to doing that. Whereas, for instance, it is logical that if you centrally place something, it is going to be dominant. And yet we know that still works against the way we see things. You weaken something by actually putting it in the middle, usually anyway. There are exceptions to that, of course, and you know that when you see it. But we know that the third, simply because of the way our brain works, is a dynamic place to put something. Another way that something can achieve dominance is by giving it lines that lead to it. You know, lines that, as in terms of, you know, we think typically of the railway line leading to somebody, the fence leading to somebody, you know, a line through a landscape that leads to a mountain in the background. That will give dominance, because it's like, imagine a group of people standing around pointing at somebody. You know, there could be 50 people in the room and one person against a wall, but if those 50 people are pointing at that one person, the 50 people are subordinate, even though they outnumber the other person 50-1. They are subordinate because they're all pointing to this one person up against the wall. If you see a picture of, or in a movie, if you're watching a scene where there's a, you know, a firing squad, and you've got the one person up against the wall, and you've got, you know, 12 people here, who's the dominant subject? Yeah. You know, it's not about numbers. It's about placement, lines, and, you know, and subordination. Think about that when you're placing your subject. What is dominant? That must be your subject. What is subordinate? Well, if everything else must be subordinate and supportive too. If it's fighting, then it's going to be a problem. Now, let's put a balance on this though, because sometimes when you've got, and I suppose it's par for the course, you've got a sea of things that are the same, and then something in this image that is completely different, such as, for instance, I was saying that the red rose or the red flower photograph that I've often shown, it breaks the rhythm and it doesn't conform to everything else in the frame. So it is the first thing you see. So it's red as against green. It's placed in the top left dynamic intersective third, and it doesn't conform to anything else in the photograph. So again, even though it's very small, it is placed, it has every reason to sing out at you, because I've deliberately given it so many reasons to live in that photograph. It's small but powerful because of those things. It's red, it's placed there, it's depth of field, and it doesn't conform to the rest of the things in the image. So think about that. How can I put those elements in my frame next time I'm taking a portrait, for instance? Now, a common wedding photograph is the bride and groom with the bridal party. Now, the bride and groom stand out because of the way they're dressed. That's one thing. So they don't conform necessarily, although the groom will conform more to his groomsman than the bride will to bridesmaid, because usually she's in a very, very large white dress or, you know, a different color to the bridesmaids. But there should still be more reason for them to stand out. And that's your challenge in a group style photograph. What can I do to even further enhance the bride and groom? Even though I want the photograph with the bridal party support the bride and groom in the image. Think about how you'd do that. Where would you put the bride and groom? Would you use, you know, composition? Would you set them apart? Would you use depth of field? Would you use light to highlight the bride and groom and darkness? Would you put the background, put them in a darker position under the shade of a tree, perhaps, in the background? Would you have them sharp? Would you have them out of focus? To what degree would you have them sharp? And would you have them out of focus? All of these things come into play when we're talking about making the subject dominant and everything else subordinate. Those are the questions that, well, you should ask yourself in the beginning, and then will later on just become a natural part of your process so that you don't even know you're doing it. And if you can do that, if you get to that point, you'll find that your images and the subjects in your images will stand out to the point where, as we've often said, no one needs to ask you, what is this photograph about? I look at the images that we have in Flickr, and there are some that just scream out at me, oh, that's the subject, and look at that. Others have great ideas, but in my opinion, fail because there is no dominant thing. You know, there's no reason for being. We try to put too much in, and everything is dominating. And you know what happens then? It's just a big fight. It's like, you know, it's like a room full of insecure bullies, you know, and, you know, trying to fight. I'm the top dog. I'm the top dog. There has to be, you know, every photo should have a top dog, and everything else should be, you know, in the pecking order, underneath it, supporting it, saying, yes, we agree, you're the subject. And so if we need to explain it this way, if we haven't understood it before, then perhaps think of your subjects and the elements within your frame as that which is dominant and that which is subordinate. If you can separate the elements in your frame into those two groups and then go through the processes you know of how to achieve that, which are color, placement and composition, depth of field, high key versus low key, lighting, all of those things that conformity, non-conformity, whatever the situation is, and use those elements to ensure that you have a subject dominant and everything else supports. If there's something in that frame that is trying to muscle its way in on the dominant subject, get it out, remove it, do something about it. Because it will only upset the marriage. It will only upset the apple cart. It will only upset the family that is your photograph. And perhaps those two words, dominance, subordination, will from this point on hopefully help you, you know, to make more powerful statements with your subjects in your photographs. I thought it was an interesting way to express the difference between subject and context as you know, both as dominant and subordinate. If you have any thoughts on that subject, let us know. But I'd really love to see some examples where you've done that, where you've said, yes, that's what I'm going to do, and take this on board, as we always love to do. Send them to Flickr, send them to us, but yep. We'd love to see some of your examples of dominance and subordination. And that does, I'm not talking about ladies in leather gear. okay, please, no photos. Just what you've decided is that, you know, or what you've come up with is, hey, yes, I see it now. Here's my example of dominance and subordination.
Cool. Excellent.
There you go.
Thank you.
So, yes, and of course, when are we announcing our prize, Bruce?
Episode 91.
And we are on?
89.
89. So not next week, but the podcast after. So you've got a couple of weeks to get those window light portraits in. And of course, last week we talked about how to do a window light portrait. And we got some nice comments about, you know, the fact that it was short but pithy, and and no, I don't speak with a lisp, and you know, so it worked very, very well. So let's hope that you can take those comments on board. If you have any questions on the subject, please let us know. And of course, even take today's podcast lesson as dominance and subordination, of dominance and subordination into the making of your window light portrait, and you'll see it work.
Absolutely.
You'll see it, you know, start to really, really work.
Yep.
So there you go. That's this week. I hope everybody's enjoyed it. And again, thank you all so much for your interaction. It's making this whole process so much more enjoyable and rewarding for Bruce and I, because we're getting to see, you know, everything that's happening on the Flickr side. And again, that was just such a great idea. And, you know, we're getting to see everybody's, you know, benefiting from the podcast, which is good for us. We really enjoy that, and good for you, you know. So keep up the good work.
Absolutely. Now, do we want to float the idea that you and I were talking about before we started recording?
Yes, all right.
Okay.
All right.
Before Shelton and I began recording, we were talking about a video tutorial that Shelton did on depth of field, which is available on YouTube, and I'll put the link to it in the show notes for this episode so that you can click through and have a look at it if you want to. What we were toying with as an idea was, how would you guys feel if we were to produce a video podcast, you know, maybe once a fortnight or maybe do it once a week? I don't know. We'll just have to see how time-consuming it becomes. But it would not be free, simply because of the time and the work that is involved for both of us to do it.
Yep.
How would you feel about something like Shelton's Depth of Field tutorial that he's done that's on YouTube? Go and check it out. If we did something like that on a regular basis on the same sorts of topics that we regularly cover on the podcast, it would not be as long as this, obviously.
It would they'd be much maybe more 5 minutes tops.
Yeah.
Mm.
Five minute
tops.
Video. And we would set it up as, you know, either a really small amount on a per episode basis, or probably the preference would be to have a quite reasonable annual subscription to it of, you know, say $20 or something like that. How would you guys feel about that? So we're keen to hear some feedback on that as a concept. Not saying we're definitely going to do it, just want to get some feedback from you guys. Would you be interested in it? Would you pay for it? What would you consider a reasonable sum for it? Yeah.
Anything
the reason you want to add to that, mate?
Simply that we are talking in audio about a visual subject.
Yeah.
So far, you guys, if you know, you've really enjoyed
you've
it.
Dealt
and
with
it's
well.
We, you know, it has and it's worked. Obviously, it's
yeah.
worked. But there are, but we upload photos and that kind of thing. My idea is, you know, I mean, naturally, this would not be at the expense of Shutters Inc.
Oh no. No.
You know, don't think that it's not an either or. But imagine that if, as we were talking, you know, let's say we're talking about the concept of depth of field, and please, everybody, have a look at it. Make your comments about it. It has actually, this depth of field tutorial that I did as an experiment, and a friend of mine uploaded it to YouTube, and it just went everywhere. If I type my name in,
it's had something like 58,000 views.
Yes. That's the thing. So and if you type in Shelton Muller depth of field into Google, there people have stolen this little bit of video and put or linked it and put it all over the internet.
Yeah.
And it actually gets excellent reviews. And I was thinking, well, yes, imagine that while you're talking, you know, you're actually seeing a slideshow that says, well, this is what happens if you now see the problem we have here. Let's say we now correct it by doing this. Ah, see what happens.
Yeah.
That's basically the way we want to present it to you, so that you can see what happens when you apply a graduated filter. What happens when you increase or decrease depth of field? What happens when you change the, you know, perspective of your lens, use the same or different lens to shoot the same thing? What happens when you change your exposure and make something high key or low key? What happens when, you know, you use flash off camera? What, you know, if you saw a slideshow that actually told you or went through this process, imagine the benefits to you, because you're hearing a podcast like Shutters Inc., but seeing
the images,
which is
full of crap, giggle, and a photo tip.
We would probably, yes, we would probably dispense with the crap giggle, I think. We'd have to.
Yeah.
It'd just go straight to photo tip. So,
so it'd be nowhere near as entertaining.
It wouldn't be as entertaining, yeah. Although, I could sing a song at the end if everybody wanted, you know. What a picture, what a picture. Rum tiddly yum tum 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 tum. Stick it in your family album. You know, I mean, you could do that. But just look, it's a thought. We would make it, you know, not a particularly expensive thing to do because we want to get numbers rather than, you know, five people paying $1,000. We'd rather have, you know, 1,000 people spending $20. You know, but it's
I
just
like
an idea.
The way you think.
Yeah. it's, you know, I've got to get that Maserati sooner or later, but no, it would work. We would make sure that it would be certainly worth your money. And I think, to be honest with you, what I have in mind, the ideas that I have in mind, would change the way you take pictures. That's my whole aim, by this idea, is to give you 5 minutes of viewing that will change how you take pictures. That's really the whole idea. There are so many Photoshop tutorials on the internet, and they've changed the way I Photoshop. Some are so much better than others, and I want to do that as a photographer, but because of the time involved, it couldn't be done for free. It would have to have, you know, another aspect to it, which would mean a membership aspect. If you like the idea, don't just sit there and think, I like the idea. We need to know.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we can't go ahead with it. We would need to have your emails, your input to say, yes, we'd support this. We would love to have 5 minutes a week that would change the way we take pictures. And that's worth $20 to us or $30 to us or whatever you think.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Bruce and I might be, well, he's already got a sports car, but I don't, everybody. All right?
It's not really a sports car.
Oh, come on. Spare me. You're going through a midlife crisis and you need... You need your hair blowing in the wind. You know, spare me. I have less hair than I did a few years ago, and so I don't have an issue. I need a hard top. I want a hat, actually, but that's another question. If you like the idea, anyway, please let us know, because it's something that we could certainly do very well. And I would, as I said, make it 5 minutes that would change the way you take pictures.
Beautiful.
All right.
Send us your email, studio@audiotu.com. Or if you want to write to Shelton... Shelton@audiotu.com.
Mm-hmm. That's me.
Beautiful. All right, mate.
Fabulous. Thanks, everybody, once again. And let us know your ideas on either whether you like it, how you'd want it to work, etc., etc.
Beautiful. Talk to you next week.
Good on you.
See you, mate.
See you, mate. Bye.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.